The ABC drama series 30-something, which premiered in 1987 and spent 4 years telling its stories about a group of young professionals living in Philadelphia, has never been released on VHS or DVD until now. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, takes a second look at the series, a series that took him a while to embrace the first time around.
It's been 20-something years since the premiere of ABC's 30-something. 22 years, to be exact. Shout Factory has just released a box set of Season 1. It took that long because of the music. The series used a lot of popular songs on the soundtrack, songs whose rights were expensive to secure for home video. But they're all in there, so what you'll see and hear when you watch this complete first season set is what audiences saw and heard back in 1987. That's the good news. But it's also the bad news. I vividly remember hating 30-something when it premiered. I was 30-something then, and married with 2 young kids of my own, so I should have loved it. Many of my friends did. But to me, these yuppie characters were either too noble or too whiny, and all of them spent far too much time talking about their feelings. But I also remember not giving up on the show, and eventually being won over. Not long into the run of 30-something, as both the characters and their problems became more substantial, I was hooked. Eventually, one of the characters got cancer, another died in a traffic accident, and others went bankrupt and had to work for a satanic boss at a large corporation. Looking at the first season after all these years supports both of my initial impressions. Series creators Marshall Herskovitz and Ed Zwick, who went on to have enviable careers in both TV and movies, started awkwardly, but were fast learners. Despite some solid performances and funny scenes, though, the first 3 episodes of 30-something are just as off-putting as I remembered them. Honestly, when one of the big conflicts is having to postpone a reservation to play squash, I don't want to embrace these characters. I want to slap them. But in episode 4, a conflict at a dinner party between 2 of the characters, the long-married couple Nancy and Elliot, is reenacted from 4 separate perspectives, each with a distinctly different take on what happened. It's a very clever episode, and a very ambitious one. And from that point on, 30-something keeps getting better and better. The conflict between Nancy and Elliot, for example, is explored fully rather than solved and tucked away after that one episode. They spend much of the season sniping at each other, subtly but constantly, until they finally decide to go see a marriage counselor. Their sessions play like an 80s version of HBO's In Treatment, with small complaints eventually leading to big observations. Here are Patricia Wedig and Timothy Busfield as Nancy and Elliot, with Marshall Herskovitz, the show's producer, as the therapist who listens patiently before offering his own observations.
I just think in these days you don't quit a job when you're making really good money to start your own company, which might ruin us. I mean, Michael and Elliot had no experience doing this before.
Wait a minute. We had won 2 awards, and we had 3 separate accounts that were promised to us. I mean, that's a great start.
They were local awards.
Oh, excuse me. They forgot my Clio this year. I mean, what if you won lately?
No, I'm just saying that it's a risky thing to do.
You didn't have any faith in me. That's what it was.
I was worried about the mortgage.
You did not have any faith in me.
No, faith has nothing to do about it.
What do you mean faith has nothing to do with it? That's the whole idea of what we're doing here, Nancy. Wait, am I crazy? I mean, I'm doing something that I've dreamed about for a long time, and she doesn't trust me at all.
I have had the same car for 7 years.
Because you enjoy being cheap, Nancy.
No, that's not what it is.
Don't lay that on anything else.
You have to have everything you want when you want it. That's true.
You know, what's interesting is that for every accusation, there's a counter-accusation, and each one seems plausible in its own way. I guess it could go on that way forever.
What's that mean?
Could go on that way forever, and neither of you would be any closer to getting what you want from each other.
This sort of scene and discussion was rare on broadcast TV then. It's rare on broadcast TV now. Dramas about everyday life are as few and far between in the start of this century as they were at the end of the last one. So even though it took the show a while to find its true voice, give 30-something credit for looking for inspiration and meaning in the little things. Where the show also deserves credit, and this is much more clear in retrospect, is in its eye for talent. Some of the regulars have starred on other terrific shows, Ken Olin on Easy Streets, Tim Busfield on The West Wing. And almost every episode in this first season serves up a surprise. The ditzy receptionist at Michael and Elliot's ad agency? She was played by a very young Faith Ford, pre-Murphy Brown. And that's Terry Kinney, who went on to HBO's Oz as Ellen's boss and eventual boyfriend. And that extended salute to Hitchcock films, in which Gary falls in love with a woman for the first time? That was written by Paul Haggis, who went on to create Easy Streets, as well as to write the movies Million Dollar Baby and Crash. And the enchanting young woman? She was played by Dana Delaney, before the rest of us fell in love with her on China Beach. The closely bonded young adults of 30-something paved the way for such subsequent television series as Seinfeld and Friends, for example. But those were sitcoms. As a drama, 30-something was and is something special. The series definitely has its place in TV history and deserves a place on your home video bookshelf as well.
David Biancooley writes for TVWorthWatching.com and teaches television and film at Rowan University.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Wednesday nights on Fox Television, a wickedly funny cheerleading coach named Sue Sylvester totally rules.
You think this is hard? Try being waterboarded. That's hard.
The show is Glee, a subversive musical comedy, and Jane Lynch, as Sue Sylvester, steals just about every scene she's in. Most likely you've come across Jane Lynch, a character actress, 6 feet tall, short blonde hair. She's been in countless TV series, Two and a Half Men, Boston Legal, CSI, and in tons of movies. She was the poodle handler in the Christopher Guest mockumentary Best in Show, and the sexually charged store manager in The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
I'm very discreet, but I'll haunt your dreams.
And here she is again in Glee, warning the Glee Club teacher to stay in his place.
Let's break it down. You want to be creative. You want to be in the spotlight. Face it, you want to be me. So here's the deal. You do with your depressing little group of kids what I did with my wealthy elderly mother. Euthanize it. It's time. And I'll be happy to offer you a job as my second assistant on Cheerios. You can fetch me Gatorade, launder my soiled delicates. It'll be very rewarding work for you.
That's Jane Lynch as the cheerleading coach Sue Sylvester on the show Glee. Jane Lynch, how do you describe your character when you try to explain her to other people?
Power hungry, ruthless, cruel, delicious, self-confident. This woman has no inner doubt. She doesn't have much reflection going on.
And she has what seems to be an endless supply of Adidas tracksuits.
Yes, indeed. And they get Nike as we move on. Because Fox is big with Nike, so we kind of share the Nike Adidas thing. And
oh,
then
I see.
By the end of the, I have about 14 tracksuits in different colors. As you've seen, I've got a hot pink one. We're going to see a neon green and gray that'll be coming up in a few episodes. It's like slipping into your pajamas. When you go to work. I love it.
Well, Sue Sylvester gets a regular slot on the local TV station. It's called right. Sue's Corner. This feeds into her sense of glory.
Mm-hmm.
She is, in one episode, a strong defender of caning.
Yes, indeed. Well, it works. Look at the spotless streets of Singapore.
Yes, we cane.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we cane. She's also a great advocate of littering.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's play this scene. The station executive is bringing in a big, pretty hefty wad of hate mail. She's mm-hmm. done a commentary in favor of littering, and here's how she defends herself.
Well, Mr. McClung, your station didn't hire me because I was yellow. And not everyone's going to have the walnuts to take a pro-littering stance, but I will not rest until every inch of our fair state is covered in garbage. That's why I pay taxes. And it keeps garbage men earning a living so they can afford tacos for their family.
What a sweetheart.
You just want to take her home.
Yeah, you do. Everybody needs a nice Sue Sylvester in their home.
Do you ever find you start thinking like her, that you know something comes up and you flip into Sue Sylvester mode in real
life? Melissa, she's not far from the surface, let me tell you. I don't have to dig very deep to find that contemptuous strain in myself. I just, you know, I want to live in this society and I want to present well, but so I keep that under wraps. But boy, when I put on that tracksuit, it comes out.
Well, you do. You chew on these one-liners like they're just a tasty snack. Here's one of my favorites.
I'd love to stay and chat, but I got a satellite interview. That's lingo again. For an interview, be a satellite.
You know, I don't improvise very much in the show, but I did make that one up.
You made that one up?
Yes, I made that one up. I will claim the ones I made up.
You studied classical theater in college, right?
Yeah. I went to Cornell University at the in the master's program there, and it was pretty well-rounded and holistic, but we did a lot of, fencing and dance and analysis and, Shakespeare and Moliere and...
Fencing?
Yeah, fencing. That was really good. That's great for strength and coordination. It's not easy to do that. It is really... a physically and mentally demanding sport, and that it's a great way to train an actor to get out of being just a nodding acquaintance with their body.
I could see some fencing working its way into Glee.
Wouldn't that be fun?
I
would love to challenge somebody to a duel.
Why do I think you would win?
Oh yeah, you betcha I would. I'd probably poison the tip of my foil.
So after, you went on to Second City, the improv and comedy troupe out of Chicago.
I did. I toured with them. It was one of the many resumes I sent out that week, and it was the only one that bit. I always ended up having the funny part in Shakespeare, but I really thought that I'd be doing theater. That was my ambition for myself, and I ended up getting this job and touring all over the place, and I fell in love with sketch, not so much improv. That's a different kind of improv than the stuff I do with Christopher Guest. This is kind of let's get to the joke real fast. And so I wasn't great at that, but I love sketch.
You know, you have done, I was looking at your list of stuff that you've been in, both on TV and on movies. I mean, mm-hmm. Two and a Half Men, The L Word, Boston Legal, Friends, CSI, The West Wing, it goes just on and on. Do you ever have this happen where you're, in a hotel somewhere watching mm-hmm. channel surfing, and there you are, and you've completely forgotten that you did that?
Yes. I did it Married with Children, and I flipped by it. All of a sudden, a very young version of myself walked out of a hotel room and said, "You must walk my Winky." And I went, "Oh, my God." I was talking about my dog, but, of course, the double entendre can't be denied. So that was kind of like, oh, geez. And I went back in time and realized, yes, indeed, I have done it and Married with Children.
You'd forgotten.
Completely forgotten.
Oh, and I guess it'll happen more and more, right?
Yeah, probably.
Because of memory loss and...
I know, and I'm just on the verge of menopause, and I'm just losing all sorts of things. I can't even tell you what I had to eat for breakfast. I can't even tell you if I ate breakfast.
when you think about the projects you've done, and you've bounced around from so many shows to movies and back, is it strange for you, first of all, to find yourself doing something that has such staying power that you're filming so many episodes for?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to do something where I could hang my hat. The nature of the work I've done lately has been, three or four days here, there, and I travel a lot. I haven't had a character arc. I've basically just had scenes here and there. And so when I got the opportunity to do Glee, I was absolutely thrilled. And they've given me a life. They've given me a backstory. The character gets affected by things. And, of course, she doesn't change very much.
We don't want her to evolve.
No. There will be no changing and evolving or growing. There will not be a lot of hugs given at any point from Sue Sylvester. But it's really fun to come to the same place to work every day. I brought a pillow and I have a candle in my trailer and, I'm a blow dryer and a little coffee maker. It's really nice to set up shop somewhere.
But do you miss the fluidity and the flexibility of bouncing from project to project?
No. I don't miss it at all. I've done it. I'm really glad to be home, and I hope this lasts a good long time.
Well, it's great fun to watch. Jane Lynch, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
You can hear more from Jane Lynch about what's coming up this season on Glee and watch Sue Sylvester in action at npr.org.
Next, we open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine, which we do just about every week, to find interesting stories about the way we live now. Today, we focus on a legendary figure for many Washingtonians, and by that we mean the people who live in D.C. Not the tourists who visit the monuments, not the people who ride around in chauffeur-driven town cars, no disrespect, but the people who live in the parts of town the tourists and big shots rarely visit. His name is Chuck Brown, and he is known as the Godfather of Go-Go. Give me the bridge now. It's a style of music that blends African and Latin beats as well as the call and response tradition common in many black churches. Go-go has been around for more than 30 years, and the music is widely sampled, which is to say beats and melodies are borrowed by other artists. But as a genre, it's had some difficulty breaking out past the greater Washington, D.C. area. Now at 73, can I tell it? 73 years old.
Yes, of course.
And nearly 20 albums under his belt. Chuck Brown is still looking for ways to expand Go-Go's reach, and he's with us now. Welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
And I just have to mention, you're looking as fabulous as always. You got your signature look. He's got his signature snap brim fedora.
Thank you.
Let's see, it's fabulous.
Thank you.
Just overall fabulousness is in the house, I just have to mention. So, having a little trouble working the headphones over his chapeau, but he's given it his best effort. So let's give a little taste of the go-go sound. Here's Wind Me Up, Chuck, from your 2001 live album. Here it is.
I want y'all to make some noise, kiddo. One more time. Say what? I love you so much. Oh, you're spoiling me now. You're spoiling me, y'all. I want to start off easy. You're so breezy. I want to start off easy, y'all. A little bit loud.
See, we're having a little trouble bringing the music down because we're kind of in the groove now. What is it about go-go how do you describe it?
You know, it's a groove. It's a feeling, you know, that goes on and on and on. That's why they call it go-go, you know, because I've said this time and time again. You know, back in the day when I got the idea of creating this sound, they had go-go clubs, go-go girls, you know, and no go-go music. So I decided to call it go-go music. You know, we were doing top 40, and all we did was just cut it down, drop the percussion in there, which the idea came from the Los Latinos, the band that I played with earlier, and also that African feel. And call and response, you drop it down and you talk to the people and they talk back to you. And that's how I got started. I was trying to get it started in 1972 when I put out a tune called We the People. And I came back with another tune called Blow Your Whistle. And the kids were shaking tambourines, riding their bicycles. And Max Kidd gave me the idea to write a song called Blow Your Whistle. You know, he was a great producer, Max Kidd. He produced that. And he also turned us on to people like Don Cornelius and got us into the Soul Train thing.
But is it tiring? I mean, one of the things about it does go on and on. Does it wear you out?
Not me. No. Not yet. Not yet.
Not
and,
even.
You know, we used to play 4 hours without stopping. We played as much as 4 hours without stopping. We played 3 hours, and not here recently, we've done 2 hours, 2 hours and a half without stopping. This is what we like to do. I like to take breaks, you know what I'm saying? Once we get them people on that flow, we want to keep them on there.
I see. Now, you know, I think a lot of people, even if hard to imagine, they're not familiar with Chuck Brown, but on the off chance they're not, many people will have heard Go-Go sampled, as we mentioned, in other songs. A prime example would be Nelly, who sampled Bustin' Loose for his 2002 mega hit, Hot in Here. And I'm going to play just a little bit. Here it is.
No deceiving, nothing else for Steven, no teasing. I need you to get up on the dance floor. Get that man what he asking for. Cause I feel like Bustin' Loose, and I feel like touching you. And can't nobody stop the juice. So baby, tell me what's the use.
Okay, that's a very good place to have a little little edit there, since we don't know whether little ears are listening right now. So, but how do you feel about being sampled?
You love it.
You don't feel like people are like stealing your thunder.
It. That's the best thing that can happen to you. It keeps you going, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, I appreciate the fact somebody thought enough of my music to sample it. In 1976, that's when the go-go started catching on. You know, and from then on, I did a tune called Bustin' Loose. I started doing it in 76, and we recorded it in 78. and it became a number one hit in the country.
Well, sometimes people are flattered by it, but on the other hand, sometimes people feel irritated because they don't necessarily feel that the original works have perhaps gotten the appreciation from the widest audience that they might prefer. And in fact, there are those who say that one of the reasons that Go-Go hasn't traveled as far as its own genre outside of the D.C. area is that it's best experienced live. That if you're there, you really feel it as a kind of a crowd in-person experience. Do you think that's true?
Well, that's where you get the full effect of Go-Go. You got the crowd there with you, you know. But in the studio, it is hard to get it. But you can get some nice, clean hits out of the studio, which I'm fortunate enough to say that we have, you know. And I'm also fortunate enough to say that Go-Go has gone all over the world. See, that's a statement that people say Go-Go hasn't gone nationwide. Those people really don't know. It hasn't hit every city in the United States, but it has hit the major cities because I've been to them. And the first time up in 1970, I think it was in 74, I recorded Air Record. I was trying to get some Go-Go together then. That was in 1970. We played at the Sugar Shack in Boston, Massachusetts. And that was quite a while back. And people really liked it. And I was testing it then. So in 1972, that's when I started cutting. I cut my first record.
Well, but maybe it's a thing where people will recognize an Atlanta sound or a Minneapolis sound, or maybe they just don't associate D.C. with the music scene. Do you think that could be it?
Not really, because, you know, I played all over the country and all in Europe, all over Japan, everywhere, you know, Switzerland, Germany, Japan, Osaka, Yokohama, Nagoya.
I understand you're huge in Japan.
Yes, ma'am.
How'd that happen?
They like our music. They like our music, and I've been over there several times, you know.
Is it different? I mean, do you get a different response? How does it from performing in D.C. and then performing in Japan?
They are really into it. I love Japan. Psycho! When you say psycho, I mean everybody goes off in Japan. And they appreciate your music. You know, I can walk down the street in Japan, look behind me, I can see maybe 10 young people walking behind me about 15 feet, maybe 20 feet away, you know. And
I turn around.
It'll be fine. I turn around and say, "What y'all doing back there? Come on up here." You know, they want some autographs or something. So I stand right there in the middle of the street and sign autographs. You know.
Well, you are rather attention getting.
Well, I'm just so grateful for that. Knowing where I come from, you know what I'm saying?
There's a very interesting backstory, which is captured in the Washington Post piece. But I still want to ask you, and we don't have time, sadly, to get into the whole story of how Chuck Brown became the legend that he is. But how is it possible that at 73, if you don't mind my telling it, you're still touring, you're still performing, not just occasionally, but regularly?
Yes.
How do you do it?
Well, you see, some people think I'm 75, but they gave me a couple of years off of good behavior. You know? So, yes,
how do you do it?
Well, it's the energy that's still there. You know, I still have the desire, I still have the energy. I still have some fire, you know. I'm still getting higher, so ain't no point in being retired. I've told several people this. I just want to go on and on until it's over.
Let me just clarify what you just said. You said you're still getting hired.
Mm-hmm.
For those who may have misheard, what is it? You're still getting hired.
Still getting hired. So that's why I'm not retired.
Not the other word that you thought maybe that he said. But what is the secret to that? Is it just because you're constantly performing? You're mm-hmm. energetic. Do you watch your diet carefully?
No, I don't watch your diet. I eat like a soul brother. You know, cornbread, black-eyed peas, collard greens, lima beans, things like that. You know, but. You know, my wife is a nurse also, and she's been taking care of me and the kids for the last, ever since she started working about 15 years ago. And so she watches over me pretty well.
Keeping a pep in your step.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm happy all the time. So that's what, you know, I like to make people happy. I like to see people smile. I like to make people laugh. You know what I'm saying? And it makes me happy knowing that I'm making somebody else happy.
With all that you've done, is there anything else that you have yet to do that you want to do? Any mountain left to climb?
Well, I would like to see the success of my children. You know, my children have talent. They all can sing and rap and whatever. And right now I got two kids in Virginia Tech. My son, Nikos Brown, number 47, he's a linebacker, and he's doing great. And my other son is down there now, Wally Brown. He's also a linebacker, and you know, I like to see them go to the pros. And I'm not speaking so well of myself because I'm just going to do this until it's over.
All right. You know? Well, thank you so much for visiting with us. What should we go out on? What would you like to hear?
Oh, give me a little doo-wop.
Okay, we'll play that at the end of the program. Chuck Brown is a music legend. He is the creator of Go-Go. He was kind enough to join us from our Washington, D.C. studios. If you want to read the profile of Chuck Brown in this week's Washington Post magazine, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on Tell Me More. Mr. Brown, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And now the game where celebrities celebrate obscure topics. It's called Not My Job. Our guest this week has starred in smash hit movies opposite Robert De Niro, Tommy Lee Jones, Morgan Freeman, Morgan Freeman, and Morgan Freeman. And now she's doing what all beloved actresses do once they've conquered Hollywood. She's getting a master's in public policy from Harvard University. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome straight from her carrel at the library, Ashley Judd. Welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you. I am so nervous to be here. I am so nervous. I was
really
thinking about, I was comparing how nervous I am now to how nervous I wasn't when I addressed the General Assembly of the United Nations.
Yeah.
Like, honestly.
Really?
Yes. And I think then, because I was speaking truth to power in a way that felt very, spiritual, and I was determined, but oh my God, that's Carl Castle. And I was, like, sweating.
So, let's be honest. Isn't it a cliche, actresses at the height of their career walking away to study public policy at the Kennedy School? I mean, come on. Isn't the tradition in Hollywood for stars such as yourself to be involved in causes but without any expertise or actual interest? I mean, you're really bucking the trend here, is what I'm saying. Have you found it difficult to adjust from life as a successful working actor to a student?
No, because acting is what I do. It's not who I am. Mm-hmm. So the transition was fairly easy for me, except for the 20-page paper and style guide and citations.
Right. What's dorm life like for you?
I am eating a student. Oh my gosh, the pizza.
Really?
It's so funny. There's something about being a student demands that diet. It's not other way. It's not their age.
It's just something about the intellectual activity burns those calories, and you need to. Do you sit up late at night and watch your own movies on cable? I mean.
Well, actually, one of my professors, the great Jacqueline Bava, is a great scholar on the issue of the benefits of citizenship and why children themselves are not able to transmit those protections to their parents if they're citizens and their parents are not. Very complex stuff. And I'm like, did you watch Crossing Over? Did you watch my movie?
I have to ask you this. There aren't that many movie stars at Harvard. Do you get special treatment at all?
Some of my peers are here. Cohorts, do I get any special treatment?
I think if they all say in unison, no, Ashley, we know it's kind of not true. I want to talk about your background. You're famously from a musical family. Your mother, Naomi Judd, your sister, Winona Judd, yes?
Mm-hmm.
The Judds. Did they give you a hard time about not going into music? Are they still disappointed in your career choice?
I think they're quite relieved.
Really?
As are millions of pairs of ears worldwide.
Really? Did you try that? I mean, because I know my daughters and my wife are all very musical, and they all like to sing together, and I think if one of them couldn't, they'd be heartbroken. So did you feel that way growing up?
I really enjoyed being by myself.
There you are.
And I just played with my imaginary friends and had a very good time.
This is a serious question. Was it a disadvantage in Hollywood being smart? Because that is just not what people expect and maybe want from people in your position.
Do you know that that's an impossible question for me to answer well?
Why?
Because I'm really not that smart.
Oh, please.
I think that there are lots and lots of smart people in Hollywood. I really do. I mean, Salma's incredibly bright, for example.
I'm sorry, who?
Salma Hayek. You
oh,
might
Salma
have heard
Hayek.
Of her.
Yes, I'm sorry.
She's kind of gorgeous.
I tend to call her Miss Hayek when I'm discussing this. I'll go with that. It's just, I mean, I've known some people in Hollywood, and I think they would be intimidated by someone like you if they knew that you were smarter than they were. And I just wonder if you maybe have had to hide that light under a bushel sometimes, maybe early on.
I was a lot of fun early on. I stayed at home and I read the Russians and listened to Beethoven. I'm not real popular out there. But that's what I did, and it served me well. And I enjoyed the life I had doing that and not getting STDs.
Well, Ashley Judd, we have asked you here to play a game we're calling...
That prize was rightfully mine! Mine!
This week, the Nobel Foundation awarded the Nobel Prizes, and they shocked everybody, as we talked about, by giving the Peace Prize to our president, basically because he's nice. But there is a history of interesting prizes that they've given out. We're going to ask you questions about three of them. We took them from MetalFloss.com. Get two right, you'll win something from one of our listeners. Even Albert Einstein never won. Carl's voice on their home answering machine. Carl, who is student Ashley Judd playing for?
The student is playing for Doug Hanna from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Ready? Okay. Robert Lucas won the 1995 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. He may be the unluckiest Nobel winner ever. Why? A, he died from a sudden allergic reaction to the fish at the awards banquet. B, in his divorce settlement years earlier, he had promised to give half of his Nobel Prize money to his ex if he won it by 1995. Or C, journalists looking into his background after he won the prize find out he had shoplifted $3,000 worth of underwear.
I like B and I like C. What are my classmates out there? Do you like B or do you like... Raise your hand if you like B, classmates.
I'm sorry.
Oh, am I like... They like B? We don't get to do
Is that how they do it at Harvard?
I remember at Harvard getting a sharp slap on the ruler when I asked for
help. Yeah, you had to take tests, right?
I had to take tests. Yeah, like, you keep your eyes in your own blue book. What's up with you? Jeez, okay, fine, ask for help. Anyway, your choices were died from a sudden allergic reaction to the fish at the banquet, had to give half the money to his wife because he said he would if he won the prize by the year he won it, or it turns out, when he got a little publicity, that he had been busted for shoplifting underwear.
I'm actually going to go with B because
go with
in my
B.
mind it was my first. It was my first instinct.
And you're right. That's what happened. He got divorced in 1987, and part of the agreement was that if he ever won the Nobel Prize, he would split the money, but only if he won by 1995. So
he won
in 1995. It cost him $500,000.
You know what I love about that?
What?
He's the kind of person that, in drafting a divorce agreement, would say, you know, if I win the Nobel Prize, you get to have half of it. Yeah. What kind of person says that?
Hey, I said the same thing when I was divorced.
What kind of person says that?
Or maybe you've got him wrong, though. Maybe he's like, tell you what, I won't give you the house or the car, but I'll give you half my Nobel Prize money. And then he's like, ha-ha, she went for it. All right. Next question. Johannes Fibiger, he won the award in medicine in 1926. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He may not have been the best choice, ultimately, for a Nobel Prize. Why not? A, his great scientific theory for which he won turned out to be entirely wrong. B, he was a pseudonym made up by some other scientists as a joke. Or C, he had Tourette's syndrome, not called that then. And his acceptance speech, sadly unrecorded, caused some to flee the room.
What year was it?
This was 1926.
I'll go with B.
You're going to go with B. He was a pseudonym made up by some other scientists?
May not be correct.
But it's plausible. And as we learned at Harvard, that's what counts. It was, in fact, A. He won for his groundbreaking theory that parasites cause cancer, which, as it turns out, they don't.
Lots of other things,
yeah,
but not cancer.
You think he was disappointed. Imagine how the parasites felt. They were like, dude... All right, this is exciting, though. You remember from Hollywood, you always want to come down to an exciting third act. We have done that, because if you get this last one correct, you will win. Here's your last question. Barack Obama was the surprise winner of the Peace Prize this year, of course, but there were other nominees. And partisans of those people went to some great lengths to try to lobby for their causes, such as which of these? A, an Italian singer wrote and recorded the song Silvio Forever to get Silvio Berlusconi the Peace Prize. He's not so much spreading peace but love, but be that as it may. B, when some fans of Martha Stewart redesigned the Nobel Prize trophy using macaroni and rubber cement just the way she would. Or C, when proponents of Joseph Biden prepared a book of haiku composed entirely of his own utterances.
Oh, my God. Who comes up with this stuff?
It just gets slipped under our door before showtime.
I was wondering.
Well, it's a very easy question in one sense, because Joseph Biden has never said anything in that few syllables.
That's true. Well, you can cut and paste.
It's probably a long book.
Yes.
I'll go with A.
You're going to go with A, the Italian singer who wrote and recorded the song Sylvia Forever? The audience agrees, and they're all right. It's true.
Yay!
It's A. Here, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure, Loriana Lana singing Sylvia Forever.
Oh, my gosh.
Sylvia Forever. Sylvia realtà, Sylvia per sempre.
Sounds like the Irish Rovers.
Everybody! Carl, how did Ashley Judd do on this exam?
Ashley had two correct answers, Peter, so she wins for Doug Hannah. Congratulations.
Well done. Ashley Judd, the talented, successful actor in movies, who's also a student at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Ashley Judd, thank you so
thank
much
you. This was really
for
fun.
Being here.
Sylvia forever sarà.
In just a minute, Carl wants brains. It's an undead listener limerick challenge. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT to join us on the air.